I am Mark Unruh. I am a nephrologist, chair of medicine at the University of New Mexico. My research focus is actually patient-reported outcomes and clinical trials. So it's, you know, my honor, actually, to have the opportunity to facilitate the panel today. This panel, in part, was the brainchild of Dr. Neil Marwa, who's at the end there, who has some, I guess, very, very effective communicators for patients and caregivers. So the aims of this panel are to really get a better idea about the patient perspective and caregiver perspective with the treatment of end-stage renal disease, largely in the U.S. And with that, I'll give everyone a chance to introduce themselves, and I'll grab a chair for the next 55 minutes. Please, Neil.
Yes, I'm Dr. Marwa, and I have been a practicing nephrologist for the last 20 years, obviously dealt with a lot of dialysis patients, and I have learned a lot more from them than I have been able to help them, hopefully to some extent. I do wear a few different hats. I'm also a professor at Midwestern University, and but the main goal and focus of my life has always been to be able to interact with the patients on an ongoing basis with and having them deal with the challenging disease that they have and be able to follow them longitudinally. And here we have an assembly of the dialysis patients as well as their caretakers, and hopefully we'll be able to talk with them and be able to impart to our audience as to what it is to be a dialysis patient as well as their caretakers. It takes a village. So.
Good morning. My name is Karen Epps. I'm the wife and caregiver of my husband, who's beside me, Dr. Earl Epps. I was with him. We've been married when he first went on to dialysis. He subsequently received a kidney transplant, and unfortunately that has failed, so he returned to dialysis last March. So hopefully this morning, through some of our dialogue, we'll be able to talk about what it means to be a caregiver on really both sides of that equation. Thank you.
As she stated, I'm her husband. And I'm a retired administrator, assistant professor, university level, but full-time dialysis patient, and look forward to conversing with you.
My turn. My name is Cheryl Falconer, and I'm the widow of a dialysis patient who lived 35 years on mostly home hemodialysis. I'm a nephrology nurse. I've worked with dialysis patients since I was 20 years old, so it's been a really long time. And I'm here to answer your questions.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Raquel Pujol, and let me summarize it because I've been on dialysis for a long time. I started when I was 9 years old, diagnosed with glomerulonephritis. At age 18, the doctor told my mom that I was going to be needing dialysis. She was very scared because I'm from Argentina, and back then, 1987, dialysis care, they used to call them the walking zombies. So that's why she brought me to the U.S. at age 21. I started dialysis at 22. And right now I'm 49. I got a transplant in 1993. It lasted only 2 years. And since 1995, I'm back on dialysis. I'm working full-time, thank God. And also, I just finished my master's in human services last December. And I'm very happy and humbled to be here in front of you and answer any question you might have.
So, you know, in a way to get things started, I thought it would be kind of useful, while everyone's awake, to just convey the one thing you'd want people to take away from this. Yeah, if we could start, I guess, whoever's ready.
Okay. Well, I'd like to say that is that we're all human beings. Dialysis patients are human beings, and I say that in the context of light of lots of times I get the impression that we're not really viewed as human beings. As she mentioned, the walking dead, walking zombies, and oftentimes I think some dialysis patients may even absorb that type of thinking. You approach that way, you treat it that way, and we lose our humanity along the way just because we're sick or we need assistant medical care. And so I would like you to walk away with understanding that these are your brothers, sisters, your mothers, fathers, uncles, aunts, your family, or just people that you know here in society.
I guess I would like to say that when a family member is on dialysis, it affects the whole family and not just the person that has to go through the treatment.
Well, I guess from my perspective, when my husband started dialysis, I was very young and kind of a punk kid, and I didn't really respect the nephrologist very much. I really didn't know what a nepher was, so I didn't understand what he was exactly and why he told me he was going to die. But what I would hope is that you'd approach every patient from at least some venue of hope. You take away the people's hope, and it's a rough road back. And some of them are going to make it a long, long time. My husband lived 35 years on dialysis when we were told that if he survives a hospital stay, he had 5 years.
That is very tough, what she said, just said, because sometimes physicians say, okay, you have 4 or 5 years to live. And I don't believe that, because since we have life, hope is the last thing that we lose. And as a patient, I wanted to let you know, like he mentioned, my other patient fellow mentioned, we have families, we have lives. We want to make sure that the doctor treat us as human being, and also to personalize as each case, because each case is different. I don't like when they put us, all us patients, in a bag. They do research, and they say because of the research, 150 people, we must do these policies. One, I would like to ask you if patients can be included before making those policies, because we are the ones who are sitting on those chairs for 3-4 hours, and somebody that has no idea what it means to be there tell us, the policy tells you have to do this. So I would like for you to take out of this panel, treat us as human beings, take us as one person at a time, personalize our case, because each case is different. They told me I was not going to last for passing 18, and right now I'm on 49. So I'm very upset with that, doctor. So please keep us in mind that we do have families, friends, lives, and a support group.
So one of the toughest part of my job as a nephrologist has been to tell someone that you need dialysis now. But that's an integral part of my job, and I've tried to imagine what the patient must feel like. But there's a lot of work to be done. So Mr. Epps, having dealt with you, how did I do?
Well, I think the question probably is more, how did I do?
Yeah.
Now, he was quite good, quite supportive. As it was mentioned, we're all individuals, and you know, we with our physicians, we approach the situation differently. With Dr. Marwa's direction, we were able to go to dialysis education. We were able to go to a couple of preparatory meetings. And so I felt like I was quite prepared, although in shock, because it's devastating when you receive the information and you realize that physically, medically, your body has changed and you have to live life differently. I've talked to some other colleagues or cohorts in the dialysis unit. Many of them say they didn't receive the preparation that I received. They're told one day and then essentially brought to a dialysis center the next day or having to have a fistula put in, and, you know, they have little or no information. And so, as it was mentioned, if we're treated, you know, not individually, with kindness and care, and that we are somebody, I think it'll go a long way towards facilitating the patient's adjustment to dialysis. Let me let someone else speak.
While you were speaking, I was saying, where should I start? Because when my mom kept me like in a bubble for so many years, she didn't want me to know that my situation was going to get worse. So at 21, I really hit the wall because saying, okay, you need dialysis. And I wasn't really prepared for that. So I had a doctor back then. Now, when I started dialysis, my blood pressure was extremely high. I'm talking about 200, 120, 130. I was terrified. I was thinking I was going to die in the machine. I didn't know exactly how. Nobody prepared me for it. They just did the fistula, and they just said, okay, you need dialysis now. And my doctor, my mom was asking for something to calm me down. The doctor said, no, because you will become addicted to it. So we have to change the doctor. He understood the case. He held me for the first month until I got accustomed. And I started being a little bit better on dialysis. I started feeling better. My numbers were getting better. And I started thinking as a 21-year-old, okay, this machine is helping me. It's not going to kill me. And I have to say my doctor, which he retired last year, he was extremely supportive and he was awesome in all aspects. It was very hard because you have to take care of your potassium, your sodium, your fluid, chocolate, tomatoes, so many stuff that you cannot eat. So you have to be very careful and you have to know that you don't have to eat a whole plate of tomato, you can have one or maybe half and be satisfied. The problem is how you can get to that level of being satisfied. We only have a tomato, you know, the whole, you know, fruit. So it was very difficult. It was very difficult. It took me for a long time, but you have to have a support group. I'm talking like right now, my husband is my backbone, my family, my doctors, my dialysis unit, those are the ones that they are with you all the way and for any question you have. But the key is your doctor. We have to work as a team. I don't like those doctors say, so you have to do this, don't ask me any question. I'm the doctor, you're just the patient. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't. Maybe it works for some people, but in my case, I can speak for me, I like that partnership, that friendship. No friendship because I know you cannot cross that line as a physician, and I understand. But that teamwork, just work as a teamwork with everybody so we can get the best care possible.
So now I'd like to add, initially after you're told that you need this, and even if you go to dialysis education, you know, my wife and I, we attended and they started the session with, you know, you have options. And, you know, options are always good. But when they say, here are your three options. Because first I said to my wife, I said, baby, we got some options. This is not going to be so bad. And then they said, your options are dialysis, transplant, or sure death. Mm-hmm. And I almost fainted. And that's true, because I just almost fell out the chair and said, my goodness, what in the world is going on here? And so, you know, it takes an adjustment, a refocus yourself to get into the reality that you're now facing. That information is devastating, and it takes patience, as was mentioned, with support and a caring doctor to help you realize that all is not over. You just have to make certain adjustments, and your quality of life, because that's always mentioned, you know, by friends and others. You know, they're always talking about the quality of life. You know, the fact of the matter is, if you're a good patient and you do what you need to do to take care of yourself, watch your various potassium, phosphorus levels, etc., manage your diet, you know, you can have a good quality of life while receiving this medical assistance. And oftentimes, that's not understood. And I've talked with dialysis patients. After receiving a transplant, I went on as a volunteer to assist the hospital with working with other dialysis patients. And a number of people decide that they don't want it. And I think that's born out of ignorance and misunderstanding and fear. And my role was try to help them bridge that gap and understand that they can still enjoy a high quality of life even while on dialysis and dealing with this deadly disease.
Yeah. Just something very quick. What he said, it's so true. The key, especially for the quality of life, is be your own we have to be our own advocates. We have to know when they draw the blood, to know what are the numbers. And don't think, because a lot of my dialysis friends there in the unit, they say, oh, I can drink as much as I can because the machine will take care of it. And I always tell them, we are 90% depending on ourselves, how we take care of ourselves, and the machine helps us at 10%. Don't drink, don't eat whatever you want, and then go to the machine and expect it's going to clean everything, because it doesn't happen that way.
True enough.
You are what you eat and what you drink. So I totally agree with you, because you have to be your own advocate in order for you to be well. I'm very blessed. And knock on wood, I am so many years doing dialysis. A little bit break with the transplant didn't last that long. But all this because it's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of going to party and be with friends. They're eating so much, they're drinking so much, and you have to have less than this. And people pushing you and say, oh, why don't you drink? Say, well, I'm on dialysis, but they don't understand that. So you have to be on your own advocate.
So this is a question from the audience, that how do we do a better job of giving hope with transplantation, but also educating you as to what happens if it does not go as well as planned? And moreover, there are a lot of insurance issues, rejection issues, you're back on dialysis. So obviously you got started on dialysis 2008, then you got a transplant, then you're back on dialysis. Was the experience different the two times? Did you get enough education about, and how did you deal with the insurance issues?
Well, the first time, once again under your guidance and care, the whole process was being facilitated and made easier, although it's tremendously difficult. In my experience, I was during the 3+ years on dialysis, I handled it pretty well. I transported myself back and forth. I felt pretty good, and everything seemed to be, A-okay. The second time around, I'm finding dialysis much more challenging. Now, I have to face some realities. I've been told I'm older. I'll be 69 in 4 or 5 weeks. And so, my current physician says, Earl, you need to factor in the age thing, because, I'm complaining, well, dialysis is different. It has a much more bigger impact on my body. I'm tired. My routine is on dialysis days, I'm in the first shift, Lisa in Chandler, Arizona. 7 clock, I leave at 6:30 in the morning. I'm back 11:30, 12 o'clock. My wife has my lunch prepared for me. And then I'm down for a nap 1 to 4 or 5 hours. So that day is essentially done. The first time around, it was much different. A lot of times, half the time, I didn't even have a nap. And when I did, it was only 30 minutes to an hour. So, you know, it's a quite different experience, but still manageable. And it's about routine and schedule. And certainly, I think it's extremely important, as it was said, to be your own advocate. I'm the type, I call myself, as well as some of my other physicians, have called me a good patient. Mm-hmm. You know, I come prepared with questions. I have a list of it for the doctor. I push it, the question to him, they push it back. And I said, I need these questions answered. And I have them written down because it facilitates memory.
So I guess I would just like to follow up on, you know, being a good patient. And, you know, a conversation actually we had yesterday, you know, I think the whole panel's echoed that, you know, you're not just patients, you're human beings with families. And on the other hand, I hear that as a patient in a dialysis unit, you know, you kind of feel like a widget, right? You're like part of a process, and that process needs to go on every other day for you. So how do you manage, like, you know, the loss of humanity in that, you know, going for this treatment every other day and going at a particular time, and then, you know, as dialysis providers and dialysis companies, how can we make the dialysis experience more welcoming?
Well, I think, as it was mentioned, the view is as individuals. You know, it may be very difficult in your field of work because, you know, you have hundreds, thousands of people who are coming for the same type thing. But we are individuals, and I think that gets lost sometime in the treatment facility. You know, you have the techs, the nurses there, doctors coming in doing their rounds. It's all, you know, perfunctory routine type things. But these are individual people with individual concerns. I have, in talking with people in my center, there are some doctors, lawyers, real estate moguls there, people who had rich lives, and some of them still are living their lives if they're not retired like me, you know, and yet and still how people in a dialysis center approach them and function with them, it's, you know, almost like you're a homeless person, you know, sitting in a chair in a morgue, and I think we're much more than that.
So is there, you know, in your experience or yours or others, is there a way to mitigate that or make it more welcoming, make it more individualized while still providing sort of safe and timely care?
I think there is. I'm a dialysis nurse for 39 years now. And my experience with my husband was home hemodialysis for the most part. We did 3 years of PD, but that failed due to a chemical accident. But as a nurse, when I dealt with patients, part of how I individualized it, how the nephrologist I worked with individualized care for patients and helped them to make better decisions, wasn't like Earl's at all. We talked about treatment options in that the type of dialysis you choose is a lifestyle choice, and different individuals have different tolerance for dependence. And in a hemodialysis center, they're very dependent on their staff to take care of them, or they would have terrible things happen. Some of them need to be independent, and home dialysis is an option. Hemodialysis or the various types of peritoneal. I think it's a mistake to push transplant as it's going to cure you. You know, you either do hemodialysis or you get a transplant, because they don't get transplants. Lots of them never get one. And with the new system for UNOS, the older patients are going to be a lot longer on the list. and a lot of them are going to time out. Mm-hmm. So offering them choices that are real seems more practical and more humane to me, and treating them certainly with respect and as an individual with value, and their opinions are valued, and helping them to make choices about how they're going to deal with their health is important. I don't know. I guess I see it differently as a nurse and the wife of a dialysis patient.
I don't mean to imply that in the centers we're totally disrespected. We're not. Everybody in there is busy and, for the most part, welcoming, but they have jobs to do. And I think sometimes the schedule might not allow for them to personalize. And I know that varies from center to center, because I receive dialysis and traveling, because, you know, get busy living or get busy dying. Like, we get busy living, so we travel, we go places, we vacation. So I get an opportunity to see other clinics in action. And I think what separates the rubber from the road is when you have technicians who are personable, who, you know, engage you in conversation other than, you know, just injecting, putting the needles in or whatever else is going on. Some things that just deal with ordinary life. So you as physicians, fellows, or people who work with those clinics in your deliberations with them, if you could, you know, kind of help them understand that, you know, that goes a long way. It's certainly nurses, social workers, they have dietitians in the center. You know, if you could somehow, if they can and you can inform them that, yeah, each of them are individuals, and maybe engage them in general conversation. I think the doctors might call it good bedside manner. That goes a long way.
So there is a comment from the audience. It says that I appreciate the courage of my dialysis patients when they are faced with the death of the patient, especially the one next to them. Please help us develop such great courage. So this is a beautiful comment from one of our audience members. The question is, would like to know how you view the nephrologist. Do we need to be less rigid and to allow for more flexibility in how we deliver our care? So you call yourself an ideal patient, a good patient. So what do you think about this?
We just want you to like us. Is that
yeah.
I'll share. This is a, and Dr. Marwar may recall it, this is a real interaction between him and I. You know, you always have at the doctor's office kind of the sterile environment. You get put into the little room and you wait. Well, an incident occurred. I had a reaction to one of the medications and where I was hallucinating and having during the night, I would see things and and whatnot. And remember one night I saw a lion that was talking. And so, sitting on the edge of the bed, and I'm talking to this lion, and my wife wakes up and said, and thought I was sleepwalking or something. And I said to her, I said, I'm talking to this lion. Don't you see this lion right here? And so, you know, she's shaking me like to wake up, and I'm telling her, I'm wide awake. And, you know, I had another session with a full headdress Native American fella in the bedroom, and he wanted to get in the bed with us. So we had a real issue. The long and short of this was I shared this with Dr. Marwar, and, of course, we modified the medication, but where he began to humanize himself and me, one day I was there, he comes into the office, he knocks, and he peeks in and he says, are you alone? And suddenly we broke into laughter, and it became, built a bridge between us, and so humor goes a long way. Plus, humanizing the patient and the doctor, because once again, we're all people, and I think that's helped our relationship tremendously.
I just want to add to that, when a spouse or significant other, whomever, a child maybe, goes in to the doctor's office with the patient, for the nephrologist to feel comfortable speaking to that person as an individual too and answering their questions, so it's not like they're just seeing the patient, that they're taking the time to make sure that you're both comfortable with the news, or all of your questions have been answered, that it just doesn't, they'll look you in the eye and talk to you too. And I think that's important, because it is a family business when there's a sick patient.
So can I just follow up on that? It seems to me, in some cases, maybe outside of the clinic, but in the dialysis units, a lot of times the caregivers, the wives, the kids are sort of on the outside looking in. And I don't know if you've had that experience, but if you had, you know, how did that make you feel, and how did you deal with it? How could the units manage it better?
Well, in the unit, basically within the unit where we're receiving treatment, that's just basically the patient. Very seldom do I see family members in there. Maybe sometime in the waiting area, family members may tend to be there more often. I don't think a lot of family members feel that they're welcome to go in to sit for a period of time with their loved one. As I traveled, I've seen that vary around the country. Some places seem to be more receptive and others are not.
May I add something? In my case, in my dialysis unit, family members are welcome. Usually, because of infection, they will give them like I don't know how they call it.
A gown
to visit them. The only thing that they require, the first 15 minutes when the person is put the needles and cannulae and all that stuff, they need to wait outside. But after the person is already running in the machine, that person can come in with the gown. So they're very welcome, but that is in my case.
So we were talking about the courage, and we were also talking earlier in the session today about the ideal dialysis patient, or this patient deserves dialysis or not. So what I want to share here is the courage of Dr. Epps, who's sitting here, who was started on dialysis in 2008, subsequently got a transplant, back on dialysis. In November, he was diagnosed to have liver cancer. So he's dealing with that now and continuing with dialysis. And your plate is full here. And you have been taken off the transplant list, and then you're hoping. So the question for the audience is, how do we encourage the coping skills in patients?
Well, my courage comes not only from within. I've always been the type of person the glass is half full rather than half empty. I think, you know, I don't know, an internal locus of control. But just as important, if not more importantly, are your loved ones, your family, and support system. I have to say, more often than not, you know, I draw strength from my wife, and she paints a bright future. We have grandkids, and last year we were blessed to have two girls born, one in March and one in April. And so they range in age from whatever that may be, 8 months, 9 months to 22 years old. And so she gives me encouraging thoughts. And so, you know, to be honest, have to dig deep, have to look at your life and pray, always staying in prayer. But I'll tell you this. One time I was really feeling pretty down, dejected, sorry for myself. And I had a good buddy, an ex-college roommate. We were talking, and he says to me, and I didn't appreciate it at the time, he said, Epps, last name, Epps, none of us are getting out alive. And boy, did that first hit me like a bomb. But then after about an hour, 2 hours, I thought about it, and that was most uplifting and most encouraging, because it made me see and sense I'm no different from anybody else. And we all, healthy or otherwise, have our struggles. And that was part of uplifting me and encouraging me to kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps and continue on.
So I guess to me, it's not only the patients that require courage, but it's the caregivers as well. And I don't know, Cheryl, if people understood that you were basically doing home hemo with your husband for 3 decades.
Yes. I was 18 years old when we started.
And to me, that is amazing and remarkable. How did you not get burnt out?
I did get burned out.
Oh, wrong question.
We did. We went into home dialysis with the promise that if I needed a break, I could get one. Well, that didn't turn out to be true. I dialyzed him every other day for the first 8 years. We had one child, and I went to college full time. And dialysis was 8 hours long. So I was busy. I worked. I went to school. I dialyzed Greg. I tried to take care of my child. I felt like a horrible parent. And I asked the dialysis center to take him in for a couple of months to give me a break. He didn't want that. And they were more supportive of him than me in that they, you know, he's healthier at home. He's got control at home. He had his own recliner. As soon as I got home, I made dinner. I set up the machine. He went on the machine. It truly is a family affair. We dialyzed for 35 years. But when I realized that, you know, he wasn't going to give up the big screen TV and dialyzing in a very comfortable recliner in his own den with his family around and being fed nice meals that were not renal friendly at all because he had plenty of time to get it back off. I guess it just settled into it, and after I realized that it wasn't going to change, and it didn't until he was too sick to be at home the last 3 years of his life, I got that break, and I didn't want it. Because not because I couldn't dialyze him. I was an acute dialysis nurse, and I dialyzed many, many critical patients. But my son was young, and the first incident we had at home in all of our years, it didn't scare me. I knew what was happening and what to do, and we dealt with it. But my son, I didn't want him to see that, and I definitely didn't want him to be having that be his last memory of his father. And so that's why I put him back in center, despite his protest. So burnout does happen. I think with PD it happens more than with hemo, especially for the patient, because they do it every day. And that's unfortunate, because that's when we start seeing them back in the center with peritonitis or having not done their exchanges and their uremic and have to be taken off.
So most of the dialysis patients, they have a lot of other medical conditions, and I'm sure you're seeing quite a few physicians. And, of course, the audience here is majority nephrology, but you're dealing with cardiologists, internists, endocrinologists, all these other physicians. And the patients obviously talk about, and we talk about as a system, about delivering integrated care. How have you, as a patient, how do you view it? Are we delivering all the promise of integrated care? Is there a lot to be desired? Do you have to end up having to facilitate that conversation so that you can get integrated care? How is that going?
From our perspective, I believe we share. We're a team, my wife and I. And I have every kind of specialist he just mentioned. And so but the important thing, there's still a lot to be desired in terms of achieving integrated care. Even when you have a primary care physician, they still have a challenge of trying to be a central distribution or collector of information. Patients, if they have the interest, inherent ability, they need to be, as it was stated, your own advocate. And we understand that. So we advocate for my care and for the various physicians to work together. We facilitate the exchange of that information because the system is not fully updated yet in terms of where that information is shared online, et cetera. So we're advocates, and you know, I have the good fortune, I would call it, to be able to speak up for myself, establish good relationships with my various physicians. I told them, don't take this in a negative way, but nobody cares more about Earl than Earl. And so Earl needs to be a partner with you, and I need the information that you have as well as you need information from me, and I feel very blessed and very fortunate that I have physicians who understand that and realize sometime I might be the best knower for what's going on within my body.
I'd like to add to that. Most often it seems that and we both have the same primary care physician, but that person seems to be the one that's most out of the loop or the one that gets the information late, whereas the specialists, the endocrinologists, the cardiologists, the nephrologists,
the pulmonologists,
endocrinologists, they seem to do a better job with sharing that information between them, and I don't know why. I don't know if it's because all of those physicians are in the same localized area, all in the East Valley of Phoenix, and so they know each other personally, and they just seem to have a better handle on the information for his care, sharing that with each other. Like, they'll just send it to each other, whereas the primary care is kind of like an offshoot, and it seems like all of it should just kind of funnel to her in a timely manner too, and that doesn't seem to occur.
So I feel with the cards with questions that I'm in the middle of a tweet storm here. The questions keep coming. We may need to extend this into the evening, but I just wanted to take one question that came up that I think is kind of related to one of the lectures earlier, and that's sort of like, where did you go for your source of knowledge? You know, now we have real news and fake news. As a patient or a caregiver, where do you go, and does technology help you do that?
I'm going to jump on that one because with this latest liver diagnosis, of course, I immediately go to the internet and WebMD and, you know, all of those. And that helped formulate the questions that when we did go to see the liver surgeon we went for a consult, I felt like I had some background information that I could take with me. And I'm not saying that all of what you read is believable. It's, you know, very much like the newspaper. You have to really do your due diligence and pick out what is real and what isn't. But yeah, I do think it does assist you in giving you a starting base.
Yeah, my comment is that through online information, technology, magazines, your physician, him or herself, as for me, with me, is some colleagues, is some friends.
who are not my immediate locale, they're in different states. They're constantly sending me, you know, stuff from, I hate to mention it, was it Kidney Buzz? I think that's one of his sites. I have a friend who's always getting information from that, as well as a few other sites. The thing that I'm curious and caution about is all the new advances, the new technologies and things come out. And the reason why I say I'm curious, of course you want to know, but cautious, that it gives a lot of times, I think, dialysis patients some false hope. We're talking about treatments that may be far in the future. And my buddy, who's a fellow CKD patient, he's very much more optimistic and hopeful, and he may be talking about something that's 10, 20 years down the line. And our conversation about, well, what do we do about now? Because he's talking about, you know, developing kidneys in petri dishes, some of the things that you read about that maybe your work may have you involved in. I think many of us as dialysis patients are interested in what can we do now. The advances are great, but my circumstance, my condition is now. I may not have 10, 20 years, although we have people who survive 20, 35 years on dialysis, but decisions are constantly being made in terms of age, who gets a kidney, who doesn't. So those technologies and those advances, while needed, necessary, and warranted, when you deal with us as patients, at least from my perspective, I need to know about what's going on here and now and what can I do or what can you do to help me now.
Yeah, I would like to add that in my case, when my doctor goes to the conferences like this one, I would like to make an appointment and ask him what are the new stuff is coming up or what is going on. And like my fellow kidney patient said, that the problem is now. So I'm very interested in seeing what's going on now to make our lives better. And I always say, to me, it's not a disease, it's a condition that I have. I like to think that way. And attitude, it's the main point. Us, as dialysis patients, we have to be strong and we have to be always reinventing ourselves not to fall on, start feeling a little bit helpless. We don't need that. We need our group system, our support system, always to be positive so we can be always positive. Because if I see, for example, my sister crying, it doesn't help. We have to have those people always positive and give us good vibes so we can continue with our lives.
As a nurse, my take on the internet is a little different. I've experienced a number of patients who looked up medications that the doctor prescribed and saw some pretty ugly side effects and decided to take them off, just give it up. And the ugly side of that is they really needed those medications and some of them had very bad outcomes. I would hope that you steer your patients to reputable renal sites and that they feel comfortable enough with you to ask you questions when they see something magical and wonderful out there that they hadn't heard about, so that you can tell them whether or not it's something that's real or not, or if it's even a reality for them or not.
So I would, I think technology actually can be a source of non-compliance, it sounds like. Are there any approaches that you all would recommend as far as, you know, helping providers get their patients to adhere? Is there anything, you know, that we can do to strengthen the patient-physician partnership, communicate more clearly? You know, what is it that we can do to kind of help build that partnership?
Tell them why. They need to know, why do you want me to take this medicine? Mm-hmm. Why do I need more time on dialysis? Why can't I do PD anymore? Tell them why.
Why can't I eat tomatoes?
Yes, exactly. They need to know why.
Yeah, I agree.
Honesty.
Yeah, you could demystify the whole process, because the patient is usually totally in the dark or ignorant about what's going on. But do it in simple language, something that they can understand. If you use your medical jargon, you know, it's probably going to be more complicated and confusing. And I certainly would suggest if you can go up the ladder, you should be able to come down the ladder in terms of your ability to communicate and dialogue with your patients. I'm really, you know, surprised at how many people I run into are dialysis patients who are totally afraid of transplant, a major fear of transplant. I think it's miraculous that you have dialysis patients who have been around 20, 35 years on dialysis. So that's something that many dialysis patients don't realize. And many of them don't realize the benefits of a transplant. I had the transplant, it's failed, but I certainly like to have another one. But I've run into so many dialysis patients who absolutely just say they are not in for a transplant, and that baffles me. And I think it's probably an education issue where they haven't been informed. And so you have both ends of the spectrum, whether you're on dialysis or whether you're a candidate for transplant. You know, each one of those positions need facilitation. Patients need to be made aware and comfortable.
So we have the whole care plan team at the dialysis center where all the physician, the social worker, the nurses, they all come together, and the physician and the patient and the family is invited to it. Every patient seems to have a different experience related to it. Some of them have no contact. Others have a lot of contact. Do you think that's a wise way to go about the care that you need, where you are able to interact and get the information that you need? How is that working out for you?
Well, for me, once again, being our own advocate, you know, we attend. In general, I think it's the best-kept secret at dialysis centers, because the number of people I've spoken to, and, you know, not just in Arizona but around the country, Texas, for an example, they weren't even aware or made aware that there's a care plan team that meets about my care on a monthly basis, or that I could request attending that or request a hearing, or I'm a participant. It's not really well shared from my point of view. And then I think it's a matter of scheduling. You know, you're on dialysis three times or more times a week, and then the care plan meeting is arranged on a subsequent day, a day that you're not there, an off day. You know, how many people want to go into the office on their off day? So it becomes challenging. Not that it can't be managed or handled, it's just challenging.
Yeah. The scheduling is an issue, and I, when I, in my hat as an administrator, scheduled those meetings with multiple physicians for many patients month after month, and getting the team together is difficult, and that's one where I think the patient's got to give a little more. Earl doesn't agree with me there, I know. It's tough to get that many professionals together, and the doctor's time is so limited. It's a shame that in any facility it's kept secret. That's terrible to me. I think that patients do so much better when they are part of their care, when they are actively involved, and when their families are actively involved. So in my facilities, it wasn't a secret. It's compulsory.
In my dialysis, it's called the action plan care, I believe, and that's when the whole team gets together. I was able to be part of them twice, and I was on my day off of work, which I didn't mind because it's about my health. So I went there and I met with the nutritionist, the doctor, the social worker, and I love it because I get to say about my own plant care. So of course I have to be knowledgeable of how I want them or us to work on my plant care. The time can be challenging, but I'm willing to, since I sacrifice all the time for dialysis, I'm willing to sacrifice to be in that team and be part of the plant care.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we've come to the end of our, not quite hour, 55 mm-hmm. minutes or so, and I wanted to just say how grateful I was that each of you took time out of your day on the day you're not in the office to come. And, you know, I had about 30 or more questions I couldn't get to, so it seemed that this was a stimulating discussion for both myself and the rest of the audience. So I just wanted to say thank you so much.